We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
It's 2:43. South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford has apologized for a sex scandal and apologized some more, but he insists he will not resign. Yesterday, he went on a conservative radio talk show to take calls directly from the public. Julie Rose of member station WFAE tells us how it went.
Governor Mark Sanford's been making the rounds of Rotary clubs and political groups for nearly 3 months now on what people in South Carolina have dubbed his apology tour. But yesterday afternoon was the Republican governor's first time on live radio, taking calls from regular folks since admitting to an affair and taking a secret trip to Argentina to visit his girlfriend. So a lot of people were expecting fireworks.
News Radio 560 WVOC.
And for the first hour of the show, the hour that Sanford was not in studio, things were pretty feisty.
I've never seen anything that's a bigger disgrace. I voted for him twice, and I'm going to tell you, I guess that's why I've got a reason to gripe. Didn't vote for him or what?
You have every reason in the world to gripe, Tom, and you have every right to do so. Linda, you're on WVOC. It's good to have you with us.
First of all, did he not go AWOL? He's the governor 24-7. And to not be there, that's just not right.
But then Governor Sanford came on the show, and things changed dramatically. The calls were largely supportive, giving Sanford plenty of room to extol his record and plans for his next 16 months as governor. WVOC radio host Kevin Cohen insists he didn't screen the callers, many of whom sounded like this one, who thinks Sanford's getting a raw deal in the press.
The media is just overplaying this and making it worse than what it truly is.
Again, you know, if you're the guy who messed up, and I'm the guy who messed up, I'm not going to be casting stones, again, where folks are or aren't coming from. I will simply say what I said before, which is some people have seen it in their best interest, I think, to keep things stirred up perhaps a little bit more than maybe ought to be the case.
Sanford blames the media and his political opponents for keeping the scandal alive, including recent allegations that he broke state ethics laws in use of the state plane and flights on private jets. Those concerns have made Sanford's environment at the state capitol increasingly hostile. The lieutenant governor and a majority of state senators have already called for Sanford to step down. Late yesterday, the Speaker of the Republican-led House of Representatives, Bobby Harrell, joined the chorus.
The issues we have facing our state and the work that needs to be accomplished is just too important for us to spend the next year bogged down with the distractions that Governor Sanford's actions have created. For the good of our state, Governor Sanford should step aside.
Sanford insists he will not resign, leaving impeachment as the only option for state lawmakers who want him out. But impeachment proceedings would be costly and could get messy enough to hurt lawmakers seeking re-election.
If they have a special session, it actually doesn't happen, they can't seem unified, and they don't have enough votes, then it would absolutely backfire in the legislature.
That's political scientist Scott Huffman of Winthrop University in South Carolina. He says it's also not clear the legislature has grounds for impeachment. Lawmakers hope to have an answer to that in the next month. Sanford is the first sitting governor in South Carolina to be investigated by the state's Ethics Commission. His travel records are the focus of that investigation, and lawmakers are waiting for the results before making their next move. For NPR News, I'm Julie Rose in Charlotte, North Carolina.
The Governor, the book written by former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich and billed as a tell-all about what led to his impeachment in January, was officially launched yesterday. In some bookstores, Blagojevich's book may share shelf space with a book written by a lawyer who played a role in his impeachment. David Ellis serves as general counsel to the Speaker of the Illinois House and was the lead prosecutor during the impeachment trial. Ellis's book is a legal thriller. It's called The Hidden Man. Illinois Public Radio Statehouse correspondent Amanda Vinicky spoke with David Ellis about his work as a government lawyer and mystery novelist.
Your novel, The Hidden Man, is coming out at the same time, basically, as Governor Blagojevich's tell-all, his first book, your sixth. I wanted to know, are you planning to read it? Do you find any irony in that timing?
Yes, my timing couldn't be better. I just can't get away from this guy, I guess. I don't know which one of our books is going to be more fictional. I haven't read his book. I don't know if I will, but he's going to make a splash. He'll do the circuit. I think there's still a morbid curiosity with the governor. And will I read it? At the end of the day, probably not, because I've heard most of it already.
It has been said that it would be impossible to make up or imagine some of the allegations that were contained in the Blagojevich indictment. It truly kind of a stranger than fiction.
It's a funny story, because I was, before he got arrested in December of 2008, I was trying to get my next book done, which is not The Hidden Man, but the follow-up, which was a book about political corruption. And I was going to be drawing on some of my experiences with Governor Blagojevich, not directly head-on what the governor did, but things like what he did. And I thought that would be interesting. And then here comes, December 9th, 2008, and he one-ups me. He does things that are so crazy that you would have never believed that they were real. If I had written those in a book, people wouldn't have believed it. I actually had to retool my novel because of the reality of what Governor Blagojevich was doing.
Take out some things and make it a bit crazier.
Yeah, I had to make it a little more bombastic. It was really so surprising, the stuff he did. And that's coming from people like me who had been around him and were seeing some pretty disturbing things. We all had some pretty negative feelings about the governor. Nobody saw this coming.
You said that you were taking some of your experience with Blagojevich and applying it to your next novel. Even outside of Blagojevich, any other Illinois personalities or Illinois politics that have played a role in any of your novels thus far, or that you're saving up and keeping as story ideas for the future?
Yeah, there is a rich panoply of ideas and scandals that we've seen in Chicago politics and Illinois politics. I have written about politics previously. My second book was really about somebody who holds essentially the position that I hold now. I wrote it when I didn't hold the position, and I probably felt a little more freedom. Amanda, I set my books in a fictional town and a fictional state, an unnamed state, so that I can never get too close to the actual fire. And I would not ever write a book directly about an individual I've interacted with. First of all, because I think that would be a breach of etiquette. And more to the point, it wouldn't be fun for me to just copy somebody else who previously exists. I would like to make up my own characters. But certainly you draw on ideas, and there's been all sorts of things that have happened, some to the point of people going to prison and some to the point of just really humorous and silly things that we see politicians doing. And yeah, I try to fit those into the book as much as I can. Like I said, Governor Blagojevich upped the ante for me. So I had to go back to the drawing board and think of what kind of scandals I could make up that would remotely match the ones that are actually happening in his office right now.
At the end of the Senate impeachment trial, after Blagojevich gave what were his last public remarks as governor, and he gave this closing argument where he pled innocence and said, "No, I am not a crook," you gave what it sounded to me as a very impassioned rebuttal.
They didn't. Our point was on his words, his secretly recorded words. And who in the world was more qualified to testify about the governor's words than the governor himself? But where was he?
And I remember afterward, and after the Senate had taken a vote, a gaggle of reporters caught you in the Capitol Rotunda, and I asked, when did you write that? Was that all prepared? He said, no, that had occurred during the recess after Blagojevich made, because nobody knew what he was going to say. Nobody knew if it would be an admission, if he would be accusing senators who were there, what he would do. Maybe could you talk about writing that, and if at all your skills as a novelist and as a fiction writer played a role or helped at all?
Mm-hmm. Well, until the night before, we didn't even think the governor was going to show up. I thought I was going to give a closing argument and the trial was going to be over. We found out the night before he was going to come and testify, or I'm sorry, not testify, but speak. Some people thought he was going to come and just resign. Some people thought he was going to come and just say, I'm sorry. And I didn't prepare anything because I didn't know what to prepare. I would have gone crazy trying to think of the various things he could say. He was capable of saying anything. We had 30 minutes after he gave his closing argument to give our rebuttal. I went back to my office with my two co-counsel, Mike Casper and Heather Weyer, and we just talked a little bit about what we had just heard. And someone made the point that the governor is very good on camera when he knows everyone's watching him at saying all the right things, but that, in fact, this case was not about that. It was about what he said when he was off camera and he thought nobody was listening. And so we thought that was a nice theme. And fortunately, we had drawn up big poster boards of quotes from the governor of things that he had said while he thought no one was listening. And they dovetailed nicely with the very things he talked about in that final stump speech that he gave. You know, and I call it a stump speech because it was his standard speech, really, for people who had heard it before. So he really almost wrote it for me, Amanda. You know, I wrote a few notes on the back of an envelope, and I walked up there with him. You know, at this point, keep in mind, I had now lived and breathed this for 6 weeks. I had been talking about this case and thinking about this case almost nonstop for all of that time. It really sort of just poured out. There was some passion. Before I got up, literally the moment before I stood up to give my closing argument, my final rebuttal argument, I just thought for a second about what I was doing, and I thought to myself, I'm representing the voices of a lot of people right now. There are a lot of people in the Capitol who felt betrayed by the governor, and there were a lot of people in the state who felt betrayed. And I thought, what you say now, you are saying on behalf of probably millions of people in this state. And if there's one thing I heard from people afterwards, it wasn't good job or way to go. It was thank you for finally saying the things that we've wanted to say.
Can we now take that in the converse, and could you explain how your role as an attorney and particularly as a prosecutor in the Blagojevich impeachment trial factors into your writing and your being an author?
The trial lawyer is the perfect novelist. A trial lawyer considers himself or herself a storyteller, first and foremost, and that's certainly what I do when I write novels. In both cases, whether you're trying a case or you're writing a book, you have to think about your audience, you have to see things through their point of view, and you have to be able to alter your message to fit that audience. I think that being a lawyer has helped me be a writer, and being a writer has helped me being a trial lawyer.
David Ellis is a novelist. He's also general counsel to the Speaker of the Illinois House of Representatives. In that role, he served as the special prosecutor at the impeachment trial of Rod Blagojevich. His latest mystery, The Hidden Man, went on sale last week. It's 5 minutes before 3 o'clock. As the dictionary defines words, so does the law, except the law may go far beyond the typical definition you find in the dictionary. Commentator Amy Gaida helps us with the definition for burglary in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
If I ask you what the word burglary means, you might define it as breaking into and entering a home or some other building without permission. But burglary has an even more precise meaning in a state's criminal statutes. Here's the legal definition for burglary in Illinois. A person commits burglary when, without authority, he knowingly enters or, without authority, remains within a building, house trailer, watercraft, aircraft, motor vehicle, railroad car, or any part thereof with intent to commit therein a felony or theft. That's a pretty broad range of places that can be burgled, and that's why we had this headline late last month. Man who hid in ambulance charged with burglary. An ambulance, barring some sort of unique interpretation, fits the motor vehicle part of the statute. It's usually not clear why certain laws read as they do. Why, for example, we have a list in the burglary statute that includes watercraft and railroad cars specifically. Sometimes it's because legislatures are reactive and amend the existing law to include a scenario that didn't before mean burglary. But a court can have the same sort of guiding hand, too. Take, for example, the Illinois court that had to decide whether a person who allegedly opened the hood of a car to remove its battery could be charged with burglary. That alleged scenario fit the statutory language just fine in the eyes of one court, setting a precedent for others. Ditto the act of taking something from the bed of a pickup truck and the taking of something from a tent. It's all burglary as long as the other elements are met. The Illinois Supreme Court, in fact, decided fairly early on that the burglary statute was meant to codify pre-existing burglary case law, and that that body of law defined the word building to include a fabric, structure, or edifice designed for the habitation of men or animals or for the shelter of property. A burgled building under that definition, then, courts decided, could be a car wash, a chicken house, an under-construction tool shed, and even a telephone booth. But despite such a broad grouping, some courts have drawn the line at some point. A fenced-in lot, one court decided, for example, could not be burgled. So the next time you think about a word like burglary, one that has both a common meaning and a legal meaning, remember that while the dictionary may define it one way, courts and lawmakers can be busier than Noah Webster, giving the word new definition beyond the obvious. I'm Amy Guida.
Earth and Sky. Aqua.